Welcome back to the Wildlife Explorer. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the wonderful world of reproduction in the animal kingdom. We'll find out some of the flirting strategies amongst animals, how has sex shaped life on Earth, and what happens if a species doesn't sexually reproduce. I'm joined today by the talented zoologist and author Jules Howard, who I met about 5 years ago at a talk when he was talking about one of his many books, Sex on Earth and the Weird and Wonderful World of Reproduction. So that is why we are going to be talking with him about that today. Stay tuned. Evidence of sex on Earth is all around us. Sex has shaped us for generations. It's in the calls of birds in the mornings, in the antlers of the deer, in the dance of the great crested grebes. It is everywhere. But sometimes the physical attributes or the behaviours that surround attraction and reproduction can otherwise be a bit of a disadvantage. For example, the peacock's tail acts a bit like an attractive gammy leg. So my first question to you is, do you think before finding out about sexual selection that these features or behaviours would have been quite confusing to scientists because they can be a bit of a nuisance, can't they?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that it was a head scratcher, wasn't it, for at least 100 and 150 or so years. But in fact, a lot of the, obviously the co-discoverer of natural selection, Wallace, right? So, he was often writing about vigor. So he sort of just thought there was this sort of life force that was in animal bodies at certain times of year. This life force, this sort of vigor, expresses itself with colors. And so a lot of the beauty that we would see in nature was just literally an expression of some sort of hidden energy. And in some ways, I guess it is. It's just that hidden energy is, of course, naturally produced, as you said, sexual selection. But I don't know, a little bit of me just reading some of his old stuff, you can be like, oh, it's actually really beautiful. But, natural selection and sexual selection, we can still be wowed by in exactly the same way, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. And sometimes, especially with the males, sometimes it can sort of be a case of look healthy or be healthy, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I remember watching, I'm going to show my age here, but like, The Trials of Life and stuff like that on TV, David Attenborough stuff. And a lot of TV then seems to be sort of naturally focusing on things like birds of paradise and things like that and expressing these real sort of male-leaning stories. And I suppose for me, I don't know, so this book was Sex on Earth was 2013, I think. I was kind of like going through a rebellious stage where I didn't just want to sort of focus, I guess, on these one half of the story. And I wanted to focus more on males and females together and how they're sort of nudging and coercing each other in different ways and sort of view them as their own weird story rather than idolizing, which we all do, idolizing, the tail of a peacock or, as I mentioned, birds of paradise. So, yeah, I was being a bit subversive, really. But again, it was a great, I loved it.
That is one thing that you really notice when you watch wildlife documentaries and things. It does seem very much focused on the males, doesn't it, as the drivers, and they're sort of the ones battling each other to be the dominant male that gets the females, and they display to get the female, and they're the more beautiful looking ones, whereas the females tend to be pictured as a bit of a passive agent in the whole act, but they're actually massive drivers of change, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, as you say, they're driving just through mate choice, as you say. In some ways, the reason that males have ended up like this is because of, millions of unseen choices of females over the years. So, I do think, and you think about museums, I know a lot of museums are trying to change their collections a little bit because naturally, the stuffed birds that are on display are mostly males, because they're, going to be or will have deemed to be the most eye-catching. It's really difficult. I mean, at the moment, funnily enough, just before I spoke to you, I'm writing an encyclopedia of birds, right? And we, at the moment, with these sort of projects, you do the writing first, you select the right birds, and because obviously I can't include them all, unfortunately. And then the next phase will be an illustrator coming on board with the project. And I just, it's going to be a really interesting discussion when we get to that point, because I think we almost, the tendency is going to be to pick, you know, the rough with this giant, crazy, you know, neck feathers, or as I mentioned, you know, the peacock. I think it's going to be difficult to, you know, if you want to express what is a bird, you know, just picking what one sex looks like at one month of the year or something like that as your descriptor of what a bird is not quite right. So it's really tricky. It's really, 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 you don't have that problem, I don't think, with all animals, you know. Ants, you know, you do an encyclopedia of insects, and apart from some of the showy ones, you know, you're not going to have that sort of discussion. But, you know, with birds particularly, it's something that comes up again and again. And I suppose, in fact, when we met, I was it the duck genitalia?
Yeah, it was.
So, you know, that was really the point. I should say to your listeners what I'm talking about. Shall I do that?
maybe mention it.
So the long and the short of this this talk I was doing at the time was that I had access to a model of a female duck's reproductive anatomy. So it's like a long, complex corkscrew tube. And it's really specialising, good at dealing with unwanted attention by males. Male ducks, as I'm sure your listeners know, they are really, really good at, they have kind of explosive anatomy, let's say. So it can sort of push itself in to the female quite fast. Essentially females have evolved some tricks, some reproductive anatomy to stop those males from getting their way evolutionarily, I suppose. I did that really well without saying any, like, you know, horrible slurs or anything like that, or names for anatomy. Anyway, so I had access to a model, a 3D model of this reproductive anatomy. And then I think in the talk, I put some sort of 3D cameras inside this model, and we went on a kind of ghost train ride down a female duck's reproductive anatomy. So anyway, the long story, that's a long story. The short of that was, like, the reason I got a lot of pleasure from doing that, not too much pleasure, I should add, but the reason I got a lot of pleasure was because, you know, it was allowing us to talk about female anatomy with the same sort of vigor we would talk about male anatomy, you know, so sort of these things you can't necessarily see that are in many ways as beautiful as a peacock's tail. They're actually happening in a place that our eyes don't normally get to see. So that really, I just love that sort of thing. And it's not often I get to do a project as fun and, as I say, a bit subversive of that. But yeah, I think TV is lagging behind a little bit with, you know, with things like that. And, you know, I remember seeing this famous, one of the famous insect discoveries from, I don't know, 15 years ago, which you all know as well, I'm sure, is this, you know, the dragonflies and damselflies. And their reproductive anatomy, the males, is kind of works a bit like a toilet brush. It goes into the female first and then removes the sperm, as you know, from a rival male, the previous male, and then the male has, you know, has his way. But essentially, there's no reason. I'd be amazed if female dragonflies and damselflies hadn't evolved all sorts of techniques to make sure the best sperm remains in the body. It's just that we haven't looked properly yet. So I think that story, which is, I remember again watching that on TV once and being like, wow, that's amazing. You know, it seems to me anyway, it's from the kind of male perspective. And I suppose our job, all of us, you know, as science communicators, is to try and tell a more balanced story, I guess.
I sometimes do our photographs across our platforms, and like you say with the birds, it's all the male ones that are so beautiful. So it'll be all like the male Mandarin duck photographs and things like that. And you think, oh, I probably should actually balance it out a bit more. It's a hard one, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. So hopefully, I think it's changing, isn't it? Like bit by bit. But yeah, I think science historians will look back on this era and go like, oh yeah, they worked out that there was actually, you know, two really interesting sexes going on, two different sex stories going on for every animal rather than just one.
And I found it really interesting reading your book about the bit with the ducks, because you said that about a third of the duck meetings are forced copulation from the males, and then only 3% of the eggs are from these forced matings, because the female can sort of contract her inner system to either accept the male or not.
The bit about that that I have always kept close in my memory is that, you know, the question is, as you say, like, what's going on there? You know, 3%, you know, that doesn't make sense. What's the female using to judge the male in terms of whether he's a good mate or not? And it was this, the research done in Derbyshire, which was showing that basically ducks, male ducks that sort of tried it on with lots of females had a lot of STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, obviously. And the more sexually transmitted diseases the male ducks have, the less bright the yellow of its beak, and it's sort of a bit green and murky when they're just riddled with all sorts of horrible diseases. And so the females are looking at males and sort of, rather than necessarily looking at all the signs we would think of, like, oh, the nice green head, etc., they're also looking at the beak and working out if they're, you know, riddled with STDs or not. That's, and that can be another factor to influence them. It's just, again, like, it's great. It's great. And it's so good that, you know, I'm always wowed at how many new findings each year are coming out, you know, and there's barely a day doesn't go by at the moment, it feels like, anyway, without us learning more cool, interesting sciencey facts like that. Definitely.
You're going to have to do a part two soon, I reckon. Now, prior to mating, as with us humans, there tends to be a bit of courtship, you know, flirting, strutting your stuff involved. In our world, it's a bunch of flowers and a Nando's date. For an animal, it might be shine a light from your bottom technique, whatever floats your boat. But what are some of your favourite wildlife flirting techniques?
I'm a big fan of nuptial gifts. So these are I've got to remember the names of these flies. Long, really long-legged flies. And your fly aficionados listening to this will be screaming into their earphones. But also the scorpion flies, of course. So, yeah, these are flies that go around plucking spiders off their webs and collating them into a lovely little nuptial gift. And the size of the nuptial gift is an indicator of how worthy the male is. And I mean insects are so great, aren't they, for some of this sort of sordid seeming stuff, I should say. But, you know, I just love the idea of you know, you think about in the evolution of something like a scorpion fly, you know, a spider is such a nutritious meal, and to actually forego eating that spider to have a go at, you know, passing on your genes is a really big evolutionary surprise, I suppose, you know, to actually give up such a nutritious meal, I suppose. So you get a real feel for how big a passion sex is for a lot of animals, you know, on Earth. So nuptial gifts is definitely one. I like the ones that sort of surprise you most. And I love that. Do you remember this cuttlefish research? So cuttlefish famously, you know, can change the colours of their skin and tentacles, of course. And there was this fascinating research where you've got your sort of alpha male cuttlefish, who are the kind of beach masters, if you like, you know, they're the ones that the females are interested in. But then you've got some males, and famously the satellite males, you know, basically these little males that are able to sort of slide in past the big alpha male and hopefully have a chance of fertilizing some of the females' eggs. So they're kind of like the beta males. They're the ones I identify with, incidentally. But anyway, the research where half, so you've got your female on one side and you've got your giant alpha male on the other side, and then this male cuttlefish, much smaller, going between the two and showing on one side of its body to the female, oh, look at my delicious, gorgeous colours. And then on the other side, showing the alpha male just a, hey, I'm just a normal guy. I'm just moving through here. No worries. So actually, it was able to communicate to different faces, if you like, whilst in that mating routine. Is just absolutely amazing, potentially because it shows the complexity of mating routines, I suppose. And it might well be that there are other examples of this. It's just that we identify with colour or colour change. It wouldn't surprise me if there was insects using smells, you know, ants, for instance, you know, on one side of the body maybe, and, you know, on the other side giving a different message and manipulating one another. So, yeah, they're two that spring immediately to mind. What about you?
Well, for me, I don't know, there's some weird ones. Giraffes, for example. So the male will use his head to headbutt the female on her bottom till she wheezes, and then smell the wee to see if she's ready for, like, fertile at that time, and then think, oh, I'm good to go. Anyone listening, if Tinder date tries that, that is a red flag. But no, it was funny about the nuptial gifts that you said, because I watched, I think it might have been like an episode of the Mating Games, like a David Attenborough one, and it had a spider, and he would do the wrap up a gift for the female, but he was being really sneaky with it. He thought, what can I get away with? And he would wrap up a flower or something so it looked like a delicious meal, but actually she just accepted it thinking he'd given her a meal, but actually it was worthless. So there's some tricksters in the animal kingdom as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's cool.
Wildlife and the story of evolution and ignore copulation, because it's such a huge driving factor for animals. You know, it's one of the biggest answers as to why do animals often look the way they look or act the way they act. So it's a really important topic to discuss, and one that I think people connect with quite well. But did you find when writing your book that we have a tendency to anthropomorphize these behaviors? So inject our own human behaviours and taboos and emotions into what we see when it comes to courtship of animals.
Yeah, I definitely did. I'll give you an example where I get a bit, not sure about that. Okay, so keeping on the theme of ducks, right? So as you say, male ducks forcefully you know, try it on, copulate with females. And in popular culture, sometimes that's referred to as rape. And, you know, that'll be like, famously ducks, male ducks rape the females. And that word for me is like, that's when I go, oh, no. One is explaining a very human condition, a tragic human condition. And to use it on animals, I felt like it was kind of like, oh, that's going to lessen its impact. So that's the only time, I think, where I get a little bit, in the way I write about these things, is that's a sort of no-no, a boundary line. And actually, I apply that to other aspects of animal behaviour. Like, so this might, some people find this really a crazy thing to say, but I'm unsure about the use of the word grief as well in animals. For me, grief feels like a human word, mourning, you know, as well. It feels like a human word. I'm not saying animals don't feel it, but they could be feeling it in different ways that we can't imagine. So it's those human words that I get a bit, a bit creeped out by, I suppose. Because we have absolutely loads of ways to express what animals are doing and how they're doing it. We don't necessarily need to use the kind of human words or human expletives, I suppose, but I sound like a right old git saying that.
Yeah, I do think sometimes we have such a tendency to sort of personify animals when actually they're amazing in their own rights, and how can we assume we know what they're feeling at that time to be able to say, oh, that is grief, that is, you know what I mean?
Definitely. So I think that was that was definitely one of the things that was rattling around in my mind. Yeah. And in fact, I just popped into my mind there about, I remember a few years ago, there was a picture that was doing lots of the news outlets. And it was a picture of a male kangaroo sort of with a dead female kangaroo in its arms. I don't know if you remember that. And it was like, wow, you know, here we go, grief. And it's in kangaroos too. They do it as well. And, you know, lots of scientists coming forward a few days later and saying, unfortunately, that is a copulatory cuddle, and the male's clearly trying to, you know, have his way with the female that sadly died, as we know lots of animals do, unfortunately, including penguins, ducks, and all sorts else. So, but that's a good example of, like, I think sometimes we really want to put human emotions onto things, but actually it's got to be done gently and with consideration. Exactly the same with dogs, by the way. You know, a lot of the way we talk about dogs is we are applying human states onto dogs when sometimes it might be more complex than that. You know, people often say, don't they, about certain sorts of crow and dogs, wow, they're as intelligent as a toddler. You know, those kind of comparisons don't really make any sense at all, because, you know, toddlers can do lots of things, you know, necessarily not just like one way of thinking for a toddler. So anyway, I'm rambling on, but, you know, I think it's an important topic to consider, you know, how we think about animals, how we write about animals and science generally.
No, it's definitely interesting.
I wanted to ask you, actually, in terms of wildlife in the UK, can you tell me an example of a reproductive strategy that might surprise us from what might seem like the everyday sort of animal?
That is a great question. I mean, I'm all about the everyday animals, just because I just think it's so nice. You can see an animal behaviour in your own house. So this time of year, obviously, the classics are house spiders, you know, and their crazy forays around our house, you know, and it tends to be, I mean, I'm always amazed that it just tends to be between like 7 o'clock in the evening and about 11 o'clock at night. That could be because at night we're asleep maybe and they're all over our beds. Don't think about that. But yeah, I just love the, you know, the fact that these males are feeling around on the carpet for the threads given off by females that have a certain sort of scent. And this routine of males approaching females and carefully drumming a tune onto the web that the female's using to assess the male's size. The stronger the drumming, the female's like, well, this guy is going to be really big and muscly and let's go for this. So I love all that sort of stuff. I love the fact that, you know, we think of our buildings as houses, but really they're just modified caves. And the spiders that live in our houses are essentially cave spiders. And also silverfish. So you know, silverfish, right? These things you sometimes see on the bathroom floor at night, and they, you know, again, it's this sort of courtship routine of males doing figures of eight around the females, and males copulating in a really ancient way through spermatophores. So gluing a little, you know, a bag of sperm, if you like, on the floor and encouraging the female, come over here, come on, yeah, align yourself just right, and then absorb this little package. So, I mean, those especially is, they're fascinating. So, you know, silverfish, I just love them. It's like they, as you know, they are like the one of the earliest kind of branches of insect life. And in fact, I learned this the other day, they never evolved a hard shell for their eggs, which is one of the reasons insects are so successful, is that their eggs are really hard and tough. And they never got a fully waterproof shell, bless them, the silverfish. And that's why they're in our bathrooms, I learned the other day. It's because obviously that's the most humid room in the house, where there's most water vapor in the air. And so essentially they treat in our bathrooms like they would like a carboniferous forest from 300 or so million years ago. It's the only place they can sort of reproduce that carboniferous kind of humid atmosphere. So it's really cool, you know, these animals.
That's so interesting.
The one is like old-fashioned bakeries where they've got that big oven. And again, there's lots of humidity, so there are some species that specialise in bakeries and stuff. So, yeah, no, I mean, I've just always loved the stories of those animals closest to us, definitely.
Obviously, we're talking about sex in this conversation, and in its basic terms, that is sperm meets egg, which results in a pregnancy or an egg being produced. And I wanted to ask you a question relating to pregnancy with wildlife. I don't know if you'll know the answer, but is it true that some animals can actually pause pregnancy?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems to be a sort of mammal thing for only certain branches of the tree. The example that springs to mind is a type of wallaby, and they all copulate in like on the same day or something crazy in January, and their gestation should be something like 4 months, but they pause it about 2 weeks in, so it's still like a kind of just a ball of cells, but it hasn't gone through the complex bit where it starts to form a, you know, a body plan, if you like. So they pause it there. I actually have no idea how they do it. It's amazing. It's paused there. And then I think it's in November when there's the spring equinox, they all start, you know, all of the population of wallabies start, you know, their egg development continues, and then they all give birth around the same day each year. And then I think locally the community sort of celebrates it and stuff. But yeah, I mean, there's so many interesting things there. Like, how are they doing this pause? How the fact that they're watching, unconsciously watching for the spring solstice, like what? You know, like, it's amazing that animals are able to do this without necessarily having to think about studying the sky. Like, you know, it's pretty cool. It's cool.
One thing that I learned that blew my mind, I was in a lecture at uni and we had a reproduction lecturer, and she was fantastic. You know when you come out of a lecture and your mind is just blown? And she said that there's studies that show in mammals certain species can control what sex their offspring will be, and it tends to be that the dominant females will produce statistically more males, and that's because their male offspring are more likely to be the successful one in the group that will spread its genes far and wide, so it's a good bet to have a male. And then other species will, if there's low resources and low food supply, then they're more likely to have males as well, because the males will go off and be able to mate elsewhere and won't be a strain on the community, whereas if there's lots of food then they'll have more females, which is, it's just mind-blowing that they could somehow have a level of control on that.
Yeah, but and also that the ecosystem itself becomes a sort of factor in male and female kind of populations as well. It's just, it's, as you say, it is mind-blowing. It's totally mind-blowing.
What happens when species don't have sex? What sort of, I guess, evolutionary challenges or advantages does that produce?
Yeah, it's a really good question. The rotifers, obviously, they're another good example of these animals that are kind of all around us that we don't think of. It's a great example of an animal that seems to have, we think about 50 million years ago, just ditched males and just prolonged itself, its lineage by just through females, basically clonally reproducing, just reproducing eggs that are kind of clones of themselves. But the cool thing about stuff like that is that those animals that try it, try to, you know, live without males, give us a great way to look at what sex is all about, why animals go through it, why they evolve to do it. And yeah, I mean, the story with the rotifers is really instructive, I suppose. And it is simply that they can live without males. They can produce these clones. They can just carry on reproducing without males because they occupy a niche that no other animal occupies, basically. And that is a puddle. And puddles are very short-lived, you know, sometimes only a matter of hours. And essentially, they fill up with rotifers. You know, these rotifers keep reproducing and filling puddles with their clones. And the question is, like, you know, how are they surviving? Because the problem is, if you fill up the world with clones, of course, is that any new parasite, any new virus or germ that comes along that works out the password, the immune system passwords to get into that organism, will immediately be able to proliferate and kill everything, because of course they've all got the same immunity codes. And so the question is, like, how are rotifers not being consumed by viruses and bacterial parasites and stuff like that? In fact, I went to go and see some of the scientists working on this. It's pretty cool. And essentially what they found was that the rotifers do get covered in fungal parasites, especially, but because the puddle dries up and they revert to a kind of hard egg life stage, they can live to fight another day. So their drying up of the pond or the puddle kills off the fungal bacteria, the fungal invaders and the bacterial invaders, but it doesn't kill off the rotifer because it's well hard. It's like awesome and can withstand being dried out. And then the wind blows the little rotifers in these like hard cyst balls, and they fly around in the countryside in dust and stuff like that. And then eventually they land in a new puddle and then fill it up with their clonal babies. And by the time the invaders come back in, the rotifers are long gone. So it's almost like I think when I was writing about them, I just considered them kind of time travelers. So, you know, they're traveling forwards in time populating everything without the need for males and always staying one step ahead of their parasitic invaders. And essentially that time-traveling way of life, it doesn't apply to pretty much any other animal on Earth. You know, we are very much stuck in our life cycle loops. We can't afford to take time out to, you know, clear our populations of parasites. So until we do, we are going to be stuck with males, essentially. So the role of males is just to jumble up the immune system passwords in populations, essentially, which is, you know, a sort of staggeringly simple way of describing something we see every single day in our lives. You know, it is amazing. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. But that's just one of the theories to explain why sex happens at all. But it's certainly the one that has the most, has loads and loads of experimental backing and mathematical modelling as well to kind of support it.
Interesting species as well, rotifers, because, I mean, they can freeze for hundreds of years and then rehydrate and just be alive again, which is ridiculous. I worked at London Zoo for a period and they told me a story of the Komodo dragon, and they had a female in there before I worked there, but there was a female in there with no males, and then one day it produced eggs and a baby Komodo dragon, and they thought, how on earth has this happened? It hadn't been documented before. And I think a similar thing had happened at Chester Zoo, and they realized that not only can they reproduce sexually, they can also reproduce asexually through parthenogenesis, so that translates to virgin birth. But it's amazing that that organism can do both methods of reproduction.
Yeah, and the pattern is, of course, that, you know, Komodo dragons, is this right? Because you'll probably remember having worked there, but the Komodo dragons are obviously island dwellers. They're moving from island to island. So in some ways, if you think of a rotifer invading a new puddle and prospering, that's what the Komodo dragon's doing. It's hitting an island that has nothing else much on it and then proliferating without the need for males. So there's the weird parallels between these two completely different organisms. I remember that at the time, as you say, the virgin birth, and it was like a really, really, really big story, wasn't it? It was fascinating. Oh, that's awesome.
Now, I didn't want to talk about reproduction without talking about monogamy. So it doesn't seem to make that much sense in terms of Richard Dawkins's selfish genes, the purpose is to sort of get your genes down the lines. It doesn't make that much sense to be monogamous because you're not spreading your genes around as much, are you? So what is the benefit of that for certain species? I know it's quite rare.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Obviously, you know, is proper true monogamy, year-on-year monogamy, I suppose, is much rarer than we used to think. For me, I guess it's a kind of something, it's a phenomenon, I would say, that appears when it's the only way in town to spread genes. So if you have populations of seabirds, for instance, you know, albatrosses and things like that, messing up the social dynamics by cheating essentially is going to be more damaging to your kids than having a stable, long bond with another individual. So I think that situations like that are kind of ecologically quite rare, I think, in the lives of animals, which is probably why we don't see it that much. Only in those sporadic sort of animals. One of the ones that the theme, again, of just linking it to animals that we know is, I think the only properly monogamous, the closest monogamous animal to us is the housefly. And that is simply because it has one sexual encounter and then it dies. So technically that is within the bounds of monogamy because, of course, it's the only relationship that organism will have. But I think in terms of like the complex monogamy that we see in nature, like social monogamy, so that's, of course, like what we see with birds, where mostly they're monogamous, not necessarily year on year, but they're also trying their hand at other females or males in the population as well. So, yeah, again, it's another good example of how culture changes. You know, in the 19th century, monogamy was an important social contract. And so they look at birds and they're like, oh, look at all these monogamous animals that, you know, God's created to show us how to live. And then, as you say, as science improves and our attitude to society changes, we start looking in different ways at animals, you know. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Yeah, I love all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Now, I don't like to, as you said, like put human emotions onto animals, but I do have to ask in this episode about love. Do you think that, in your opinion, animals feel love? Is there evidence for this at all?
The earlier one I said about that personally I have a little bit of sort of nervousness about using the word grief and mourning. And I think technically my argument should be, look, if I'm not going to use those words, I'm also not going to use the word love. Obviously in mammals we use the term attachment to talk about the social behaviors of animals. So, you know, clearly some mammals, you know, some voles particularly, can develop really lasting lifelong relationships, and they're modified and managed by the same brain chemicals that we use in our relationships. So if we call it love and they've got the same brain chemicals that we have and they're using them to, you know, maintain their social organization, then, you know, maybe it's love what they're feeling. Little voles are feeling love. But I'd sort of, yeah, I have the same discomfort, I suppose, because, like, you know, we don't know what love is. You know, I might love in a different way to you. There's no way for us to tell. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why the, you know, romantic poets are so amazing, is they're trying to put words to something that most humans can't really express massively well themselves. So for that reason, I'm sort of get a bit nervous about it with animals, and I tend to use the word attachment. But I have recently broken my own rule. And when I was working on Wonder Dog, the latest book, it's about the kind of how we've come to understand cognition and consciousness through studying dogs. In the latter stages of writing that book, I started to see that there is probably a fair argument to use that term in relation to the pets and the companions that we spend a lot of time with. So clearly dogs have the same brain chemicals that we have when it comes to bonding. And clearly dogs, unlike voles, dogs can be trained to sit in fMRI scanners and have their brain scanned. We can do comparisons between when humans see an object that they love and when dogs see an object they love, are their brains lighting up, so to speak, in the same way? And, like, you can clearly demonstrate that with dogs. So I kind of came out and was like, okay, I think that word is perhaps more acceptable to be used with dogs, possibly cats, but certainly there's plenty of evidence with dogs. And I kind of felt like if we keep, as scientists, calling it attachment, my worry was always that if we keep using this really super scientific language to explain animal behaviors, people might not think of dogs as massively socially conscious and complex. So in other words, if we can say in a scientific way why we think dogs, probably many dogs, not all, but many dogs probably do love us, if we can describe that in a scientific way, then maybe love is an acceptable term for society to hear. Because I don't want a situation where people, mistreat dogs because they think they're not complex emotional beings. So you can see I'm still like working
my way. It's such a weird argument, isn't it? And even then thinking, it seems a bit harsh to whittle love down as just a chemical reaction in the brain, and then sort of you get that side of the argument as well. So it's just an interesting question.
It's not. I agree. Yeah, like you can't just go when you have a feeling of love, like you're hugging your loved ones or whatever. The idea of sort of going, oh, this rise in oxytocin levels in my brain, I feel it flooding through, and these emotions of romance, they're just constructs, you know. And the argument's there, and it's a real argument, but I agree, like, sometimes it's better just to feel it for what it is, I suppose, than analyze it. But, you know, we are scientists, aren't we? That's our game. I do think it's actually a great conversation to have, because everyone loves talking about love. Everyone loves talking about, lots of people love talking about animals. So we have, I don't know, I feel like it's a nice way in for a lot of people to understand more about animals. So I wouldn't change it. The distinction's really, really interesting.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Wildlife Explorer. If you've enjoyed listening to Jules Howard, I recommend checking out his collection of books. He's got some brilliant ones, including Wonder Dog, Death on Earth, The Wildlife Pond Book, Frogs and Toads, along with a whole selection of non-fiction books for kids about science. And he's even writing a book about eggs at the moment and how that has shaped life on Earth. So that's all from me today. If you've enjoyed this, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating. It really does help. We'll see you next time.